Just based on a little bit of feedback I've been getting, I'm happy to sit around and also talk about the data challenges if you have questions or want additional clues for a little bit of time, depending on how much time we have left. So, I don't know if a homework was actually posted or sent around yet. Okay, so I'm trying not to, I assigned something yesterday, and then I realized it might have been a little long, so I'm not sure if we'll fix that. Okay. All right, so if we're trying to figure out, so here's our detector. Okay. And we have, you know, some flux of dark matter particles with velocity v. And we want to look for scattering of these dark matter particles off nuclei in the detector. So I already mentioned last time that the, you know, we're not looking. So we go to great trouble to try to separate backgrounds from nuclear recoils that are otherwise relatively quiet. And then what we're looking, you might ask then, what are we looking for? What's the sort of signature of dark matter scattering? And usually what we think about is the scattering rate. So R is the scatter rate. Okay. And we usually think about the scattering rate as a function of nuclear recoil energy. Right? So you look at the scintillation and ionization energy from a nuclear recoil. From that, you try to calculate what the energy of the recoiling nucleus is. Okay. And you can look at what the scattering rate is in your sample as a function of recoil energy. Now, background decays from radioactivity, neutrons from outside the detector coming in and scattering off materials, those all have a fairly distinctive shape. And actually, to discriminate those, you don't just look at overall counts as a function of energy. You look at what kind of energy they deposit in the detector. So we'll get to some of those plots when I talk about the xenon experiment. But let's talk about the shape of dark matter. So remember what the energy scale is for expected dark matter scattering off of nuclei. It's like tens of keV out to 100 keV, right? It's about 10 to the minus 3. Why is that? Because the expectation. So first of all, we do not know the velocity profile of the dark matter halo. So just I have to say that there are n-body simulations that are used to estimate what the velocity profile looks like, because we can measure the density, overall density of dark matter, and so there are n-body simulations that are formed. We try to normalize to the overall density, and then we look at what the velocity profiles are. But the other naive picture for why it's of order 10 to the minus 3 is that's our velocity. And you would expect that in most galaxies, the observed objects that we find are virialized with respect to one another. So they all have sort of roughly the same velocity dispersion. And the velocity dispersion of stars in our galaxy is of order 10 to the minus 3 in units of the speed of light. So that's where that number comes from. Okay, and in detail, the velocity profile of the halo is modeled as a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, okay, where the dispersion is given by the variable velocity of the stars in our galaxy. All right. Okay, so that's why we look in that energy range. And it's not just the velocity, it's also the mass of the dark matter, and it's the mass of the target. So for targets of comparable mass in the 100 GeV range, it's of order 100 keV. But if dark matter is much lighter, the energy can fall down. If dark matter is much heavier, actually, if dark matter is much, much heavier, it's still going to be of order 100 keV, because then the energy transfer is set by the mass of the nucleus, not the mass of the dark matter. Right? It's always reduced mass that sets the energy transfer. Okay. Anyway, so the typical expectation is that you have dark matter scattering profiles that look like that. They're basically falling exponentials. Let's say this is 10 keV. let's say this is 100 keV. This is the canonical expectation for spin-independent scattering of, and don't worry about the units here. The count rate depends on the overall cross-section, but this is the shape. So how do we work this out in general? Okay, so it's not too hard to just do a calculation of the scattering rate per nuclear recoil energy range. So you expect the rate to depend on what? You expect it to depend on the number of target nuclei. Okay, so this is the number of target. You expect it to depend on the number density of dark matter, which we can write as the measured energy density over the mass, which we don't know. So there's always some dependence on that. Okay, and then we have to convolve the velocity profile of the incoming dark matter halo and the scattering cross-section, right? So how does this work? So we integrate over the velocity profile of the halo, and the rate is determined by the flux. So that'll be V times this velocity density profile. Okay, that's what F of V is. And this is really a function. I'm going to make this as a function of a couple of things. I'm going to blow up this piece in just a second. Okay? And then we multiply by the scattering cross section as a function of energy. Okay? So this is dark matter plus nucleus goes to dark matter plus nucleus, right? Okay? So there's a 2-to-2 scattering cross section here, which we can compute differentially as a function of recoil energy, and then we convolve this with the velocity profile. Now, where do you do the integral? For a given energy range, there's some minimum velocity, right? Because you can't have a really high energy transfer scattering at arbitrarily low velocity. So for a given recoil energy, there's some minimum velocity you need from the halo. And can you integrate out to velocities that are infinite? Well, you can, but there's an escape velocity for our galaxy. So at some point, you expect the halo to kind of cut off. We don't know how it cuts off, but we expect the halo to really taper off sharply at the escape velocity or near the escape velocity of our galaxy. So that's around 500 to 600 kilometers per second. Okay. Let me just tell you what. So V escape, it's about 500 to 600 kilometers per second. I mentioned, just for reference, the Earth relative to the galactic center. This is of order people often quote it as 220 kilometers per second. Okay. All right, so actually there's not a huge range of velocities. It's all of order 10 to the minus 3. And usually the velocity profile is a function of the magnitude. It's usually taken to look like some blob that we model as a Maxwell-Boltzmann, kind of in here, and then we cut it off, usually smoothly, around the escape velocity. Okay. So we don't know this factor, so all these calculations are fraught with systematic errors. Okay, it's our best guess. And so remember that whenever you look at an exclusion contour from an experiment. 95% confidence never means, 95% confidence. It's all subject to what you think this halo is. How do you know? You can compare the simulations, but a lot of these simulations, for example, they don't have baryons in them. So at this point, at least from my point of view, the modeling of the halo, the velocity profiles of the halo, there's a reasonable spread in what that velocity profile looks like. And part of the reason there's spread is that in a lot of these simulations, you develop local streams or disks. And there's a lot of debate about whether or not there's sort of a higher density dark matter disk that moves along with a uniform velocity in the galactic plane. Or is it much more random?
It's just people who cast it, they then extract the orbit.
Well, yeah, but it, so in some cases people want those a big ball of gas. In other cases, there's sort of a disk region where there's a bit more velocity correlation in the disk. In other cases, the models include a separate radial component. There's a correlation in the radial movement of the velocity versus the tangential velocity. Okay, so there's it's not known, and if so, so. The field's getting better. It used to be there was a canonical kind of, you know, the spherical Kao approximation to the halo. We just take it as a Maxwell-Boltzmann. We don't ask questions. At this point, we can you can use different types of simulations and take the velocity profile from these different simulations, and you can make predictions, and that'll give you some idea of how all of these exclusions move around or what your expectations are. Okay. Now the other very very important piece of information is what this minimum velocity is, okay? So if you just have elastic scattering, 2-to-2 scattering, then the minimum velocity is root 2 times the mass of the dark matter times the nuclear recoil energy. Here, I'll get out of the way in a second. Okay. I can define all these symbols. So this is the mass of the dark matter. This is the recoil energy. This is the reduced mass of the dark matter nucleus system. Okay? This is just straight kinematics. This is the minimum velocity. When the recoil energy goes to zero, the minimum velocity goes to zero. That's what you'd expect. Okay? So in this situation, you take a Maxwell-Boltzmann, you multiply by something that is typically flat for spin-independent scattering through a contact interaction, and that's what gives you these canonical shapes for the recoil profile. But there's more you should know. So in recent years, there's been a lot of attention given to dark matter theories where the scattering isn't elastic. So what would happen if, so for example, charged pions, right? They're in a multiplet. They're split by a small amount. When pions scatter, they often scatter inelastically through charge exchange. Okay, so there's examples of this in the standard model where you have nearly degenerate multiplets. I mean, these should be very familiar from like QCD. So the idea is, well, maybe dark matter is like not totally boring. Maybe dark matter comes in multiplets that are split by a small amount, and if that happens, then if the in many instances, if the interaction is mediated by a vector, the scattering is dominantly inelastic. You upscatter into the nearest state. Okay, so you might want to ask, well, how does that affect the shapes of these curves if you have inelastic scattering? So that's easy to, there's a correction term we add to this. Sorry. I think I got my kinematics wrong here. This is the reduced mass of the dark matter nucleus system. This actually should be the nucleus. I knew something didn't seem right. So this doesn't go to zero when I take the mass to zero. Okay? All right, so small correction here. I encourage you to just work this out. This is a simple, just a 2-to-2 problem. You could derive this. If you have inelastic scattering, there's a correction term. Okay, and again, this is simple kinematics. I leave it as an exercise to derive it. Delta here. Delta is the mass of whatever dark matter excited state you're scattering into minus the mass of the ground state. Okay, so if you have a dark matter state, which is actually in a multiplet that's split by a small amount, this is how it would modify that minimum energy. Now, what's different about this? This is rather striking. What happens to the minimum velocity as we go to low energy, low recoil energy now? Minimum velocity goes up. So actually, if you want low recoil energy and the scattering is inelastic, you actually only get that off of the high velocity tail of the scattering. And essentially, you get it from backscattering. Okay? Well, depending on the model, this can actually also be long-lived. Or it can decay back down. I mean, we can go through a long list of... So what's a simple example of this? Suppose dark matter is just a doublet under SU2. And Now, actually, if it's just a Dublin under SU2, you know that when you break the weak interactions, you do get a splitting between the charged and the neutral state there. There's just a correction. That's not a viable dark matter theory, but that's a theory where the neutral state can upscatter into the charged. Now, that's a charge interaction. You would observe that. But another example that's better that actually does work is if you have a Dirac fermion that's neutral under the weak interactions. When you break the weak interactions, there's corrections that can split the two Majorana states with respect to one another. Right? You can think about it as there's two Majorana fermions living in there. And then that splitting is just induced from radiative corrections. And then the vector exchange doesn't mediate mass eigens. It does not mediate scattering from the low level to the low level or the high level to the high level. Vector interactions are always off-diagonal in the Majorana basis. Majorana fermions don't self-couple to vectors. So it's always inelastic scattering. Okay? Now, so this has important effects because if you have a splitting, the low energy piece is just cut off. Okay? Because the only way you get down here is you sample off the tail. So that gives you shapes that look like this. Okay? So this is with delta not equal to zero. And essentially the location of this peak is kind of controlled by where delta is. Okay? Now, is that the only way to affect the profile? There's other ways of affecting the profile. Right? So I just told you, so kinematics of the scattering can affect the profile. But there's also the energy dependence of this scattering cross-section. I mean, if it's some vanilla spin-independent cross-section that has no energy dependence, fine. It'll look like that. But the scattering can occur not through a heavy mediator. It could occur through a light mediator. Right? So, you know, so what are we modeling? We have, here, let me draw some lines here to separate some of these pictures. Right, so we have dark matter, nucleus. Now, normally we assume this mediator is something like the Z or the Higgs, something heavy. And when that happens, this is a contact interaction, which means effectively at low energy, it's just like a flat matrix element. If it's, you know, at least the spin independent types are. But if this were a light mediator, then the matrix element squared can go like 1 over q to the fourth. Right? It can have some where q is the exchange momentum. As you know, the exchange momentum, we could rewrite that in terms of recoil energy. And so now this can have non-trivial dependence on the recoil energy. Okay. So what would that do? Well, that would actually further suppress the high energy events and enhance the low energy events. Right. Now, there's other types of theories you can have. The dark matter can have a form factor. Okay, there can be some g of q squared here. That would happen any time the dark matter state is composite. Right. Now, this form factor can have dependence that goes linearly with q squared, or it can be even higher order in q squared. So that can actually tilt this the other direction. That can actually suppress the low energy events just from the matrix element. So you can actually get a hump like this, not from kinematics, but you can get it just from the matrix element. Okay. So the bottom line is, we don't know what this term is. Okay. So at least in, especially when various anomalies started creeping up, a lot of people went back and took a kind of an effective field theory attitude about how to think about dark matter scattering. So yes, a lot of models were written down that realized different matrix elements, that realized inelastic scattering, and so I would say a nice spanning family of different types of signatures were worked out, and that motivated different kinds of searches in these experiments. But at this point, if you just take a kind of bottom-up point of view to dark matter scattering, you should think about using effective field theory to characterize the most kind of the generic dark matter nucleus scattering. So that gives you some way of parameterizing this. And then, you know, just keep in mind some of the options for the halo profile. And that's enough to already just give you a sense of what these recoil curves should look like. So there's a paper that is this posted on the wiki? Okay. So there's a nice paper that goes through working out an effective theory description of dark matter scattering, which I think is very nice. The homework is largely from the appendix of this paper. So this is, I'll just write it down so you can have it. Okay, but for the purpose of taking a look at the data coming out of the direct detection experiments, this is enough. This is enough for now. I'm not going to go through calculating these. This is a straightforward. If you've done cross section calculations before, this is no different. Okay, this is a 2-to-2 matrix element, and you just work it out differentially as a function of energy. Now, I think the homework is, so actually, if everybody has their computers, you could just pull this paper up. Does everybody have it up? Great. Okay. Now, go to page 24. If you understand this paper, you basically understand everything you'll ever need to know about direct detection phenomenology. Page 24, it's in the appendix. Okay, so table 2 is a list of effective operators written in a field theoretic language in the left-hand column. And then the column over are the non-relativistic operators in momentum space. And then, you know, the position space operators are written down. And there's two types of position space operators. There's a position space operators when the mediator is heavy and when the mediator is light. You should be able to tell the difference. The delta functions are when the mediator is heavy. It's a delta function interaction. That's why people call it contact interactions. And then there's 1 over R. Those are, for example, in the top column when that's a light mediator. Okay, so the homework is actually to work out the correspondence between some of the field theory operators and the non-relativistic operators. Okay. Now, I'm not sure if this is something that you have much experience with, but it should give you some intuition. Fall off this table. For cataloging from a kind of top-down point of view, you know, you're working out some field theoretic description of whatever model of interest that's of interest to you. There's some dark matter candidate, and you want to work out its direct detection phenomenology. Suffice it to say, that phenomenology, I'm sure, has been worked out before, and it's just a question of mapping on to the existing literature or the existing studies that have been done. So, you know, so the questions you ask are, you know, is the scattering going to be spin-independent, spin-dependent? What's going to be the relative ratio? So you want to work out the dark matter nuclear interactions. Usually you work those out in terms of effective operators written in terms of your fields. Okay. And those map nicely on to the non-relativistic operators that can be used in a fairly generic characterization of the dark matter scattering phenomenology. So here this is the matching for fermion dark matter. Table 3 has the matching for scalar dark matter. Table 4 has the matching for vector dark matter. All right, this is a fairly exhaustive matching between high energy theories and low energy theories that are useful for characterizing the phenomenology. Okay. So I was going to go through a couple calculations to illustrate how this is done. And I think I do want to do that. But first I want to know if anybody has looked at cogent gamma or xenon 100 or any of the papers that I brought up last time. Okay. This is the dark matter results from 100 live days of xenon. This is figure 5. Okay. So what about it? Okay. Okay. Should I draw the plot up here? I'll draw the plot up here. So everybody should be looking at figure 5 in the xenon 100 paper. Oh, you're asking about figure 4? Oh, it's the IDM paper. sorry. Yeah. Figure four of the Xenon 100 implications for inelastic dark matter. Okay. Yeah, what's shown in this figure is this parameter delta, the inelastic splitting, is on the y-axis. That's in KeV. And then the dark matter mass. See, they actually got wise about this. People for a long time were only showing one-dimensional slices, and they finally did a two-dimensional analysis. Okay, so mass of dark matter, splitting, so this sort of fully characterizes the kinematics of the scattering with some given matrix element assumption. And then they highlighted the region that was consistent with gamma, and they showed where their exclusions are. Now, actually, this always worries me. The exclusion curve goes right around the boundary, just like it loops right around it. Well, So the claim was that this kills the inelastic dark matter explanation for gamma. Yeah. The constraint is on the shaded region.
Right.
Okay. Let's just talk about IDM for a second, because this has been a three-year saga in the field for a while, and it's almost over, but it's not like nail in the coffin's not there yet. Okay. All right. So what was the gamma anomaly? The gamma anomaly was this annual modulation anomaly. So did you look at their plot that shows the anomaly? There's a big bump in the annual modulation spectrum. It's not a statistical fluke. I mean, it's very, very significant. So if it's wrong, it's some systematic or some background. And they claim to have really studied these backgrounds very carefully. The potassium background is the one that everybody worried about. But they claim to have measured it, and they say it's not a problem. They've done upgrades of the experiments. So nobody really has a very solid idea for what background, if there is one, is causing this. So if you think it's dark matter, the first thing you'd want to explain is why is it a bump in the spectrum and not sort of some falling distribution, okay? And qualitatively, that's explained by inelastic dark matter. I mentioned, if you have a splitting, effectively, the low energy part's suppressed because you can only scatter off the high energy tail of the halo, right? Because at low energy, the minimum velocity gets larger, so you're living on the Boltzmann tail. So that's why, so for inelastic dark matter, say if I have a splitting of order 100 keV, and I look at the recoil, right, I get bumps like that. Okay. Now, it's not the overall rate that they're looking at. They are looking at the modulation, right? So this is not actually the relevant plot. So really what you want to look at is this. They plot the modulation amplitude. So you would look at this as a difference between summer minus winter. Sorry to write so small, but so this is the rate. This is sort of, that's a kind of a rough measure of the amplitude that you'd get from yearly variation. Okay? It's the same thing, though. If you look at that, you still get this bump from inelastic dark matter. Okay. Now, inelastic dark matter did a very nice job of actually fitting the data for the Dammann-Leibler anomaly. But much more important than that is that it explained, at least early on, it gave an idea for why the other experiments weren't sensitive to it. You'd ask the question, why on earth did Dammann-Leibler see this first and nobody else? And the reason at the time was that inelastic scattering happens much more effectively or efficiently when the scattering is off of heavy nuclei, okay? And you see it here, okay? If you have a heavy nucleus, then for a given recoil energy, you go to lower velocity, okay? So the situation was that if this is F of V, right, this is the velocity profile, you'd say, for a given energy, where in the tail are you? Well, for heavier nuclei, you're down here, and there's more of the halo to scatter off of. For lighter targets, you're way out here, and there's less of the halo to scatter off of. So if you worked out, if you normalize to the gamma rate, and they have iodine as the target, that was the thought, it's very heavy, and then you make a prediction for what, say, CDMS would see, which uses a much, much lighter target, you'd see that you wouldn't expect a constraint. So it's sort of parametrically explained why nobody else had seen it. And, you know, it's theoretically reasonable, it's interesting, so on and so forth. Now, the prediction was that the heavy target experiments should see it. And xenon is a heavy target, okay? Now, so xenon 10 did some studies. So that was sort of the precursor to xenon 100. That collaboration broke up into LUX and xenon 100. So there's actually two sort of child experiments that were born out of that one. Much bigger versions now. Xenon 10 couldn't quite rule this out because when they looked, they had all these excess events right where you'd expect the signal to live. So they couldn't rule it out. There was a reanalysis of their data that where they identified what they thought were some additional backgrounds. They pushed it down, still didn't rule it out. Okay, so the story could have died a while ago. It didn't because xenon 10 couldn't kill it. Now, xenon 100, they're much bigger, have a much bigger active volume. And one of the cool things about having a big active volume is that you can go to the inside of your active volume. You can quote-unquote fiducialize. And then the outside part of the active volume acts like a shield that protects you from backgrounds. Okay. So everybody expected that xenon 100 should be able to kill this definitively, just kill this possibility. And, you know, I think more or less they've done a pretty reasonable job, especially because they've marginalized over quite a few of these uncertainties. It's not a huge exclusion, but let's just say IDM as an explanation for gamma looks very strongly disfavored at this point. I mean, that's my reading of these results. Okay. Now, why does xenon 100 cross it? I know this is a little. I mean, this may seem like an accident. Now, part of this though is in part because, by the way, if you look on the previous page, they show you what the expectations are. This is on Figure 2. They show you the expectations for the energy profile of scattering, assuming that you have some inelasticity that could account for gamma. And I think they may normalize to the gamma signal here. So that's what these lines are here. And these are their three events. So there's some there's a big discrepancy between what you would have had and what they saw. So I think that's pretty compelling evidence against IDM as an explanation of gamma. Yeah. You mean at low mass?
I'm not sure. This is the gray region.
No, the gray region is ruled out. At higher dark matter mass, the recoil goes to higher energy and they have more sensitivity.
Okay, so it just so happens that below the black line is excluded and that happens to be exactly
okay. So you can sort of see where do you expect to have an exclusion? So you know at zero splitting, you'll have exclusion to So we've got to go through a couple more things about xenon. Xenon does not see to very, very, very low recoil energies. So you'd expect that if you take the dark matter mass smaller, at some point the recoil is going to fall outside of their sensitivity range. So that's why when you look at, you know, say, small recoil, there is a boundary at all. At high dark matter mass, the recoil energy would end up in their energy range. At low, it doesn't. As you increase the splitting, now, there's a little bit of a. Actually, it's not entirely clear to me if this is just kinematics or their selection cuts, why that slope. There's a slope between, say, 40 keV and 120 keV on the. As you move on the y-axis for the splitting, the exclusion fault goes to higher dark matter mass. So that's probably. I'm not entirely sure about that structure there. But the explanation for why this exclusion crosses gamma is that, you know, at some level, it was almost built. The experiment wasn't built to rule this out, but everybody had sort of identified this as the experiment that would rule it out. And, you know, they're publishing with a data set that's large enough to really definitively kill it.
I mean, they just took as much data as they needed to kill it.
No, I mean, they took, I mean, the amount of data they took was determined by other reasons, but. These exclusion curves actually kind of grow very slowly. So they went past the point where they needed to confidently kill it. The exclusion curves grow very, very slowly. So it's not too much of an accident that it's very close to the boundaries of the allowed gamma region. Yeah, why it just sort of circles around it. Yeah, they also show, I mean, they try to show the CDMS exclusions. Zeppelin is another xenon-based experiment. And then there's Xeno 100 in the black line. Now, CDMS never, there was tension from CDMS and Zeppelin, but it was never really a compelling exclusion. Okay, now there's another region of gamma which has received a lot of attention. Sorry, there's another class of explanations that have received a lot of attention. Another way you could try to explain gamma is by using light dark matter. And the dark matter might have a form factor, or at least in the light case, this shape you can actually get from, there is a noticeable difference between the overall rate and the modulation rate for light dark matter. Okay, so there's some region around 5 to 10 GeV of dark matter mass where the scattering could have at least accounted for the rough shape of the gamma signal. And then Cogent came along, it was a germanium-based experiment, and they saw some signal. And so then the immediate question was, it's a very low energy signal. And so the immediate question was, are these two experiments consistent? There was a lot of work. There was a flurry of activity to look to see if these two experiments were consistent. And there was some rough range around the 5 to 10 GeV mark where, you know, it looked like maybe if you invoked certain condensed matter phenomenon known as channeling, you could get the two experiments to line up. Okay, but again, it was always a question, could somebody please cross-check these experiments? And the experiment that people looked to were the xenon experiments and CDMS, okay, because CDMS has the same kind of target as Cogent. And so people wanted to see if CDMS could exclude Cogent. They basically strongly disfavor Cogent, but it's not, you know, you want it to be a little bit more definitive than that. So if you look at the dark matter results from 100 live days of xenon, at their figure 5, this is the exclusion, you'll see a patchwork of things labeled gamma, Cogent. Okay, this is the other paper, figure 5, so it's this one. So you see dark matter mass on the x-axis, right? You see WIMP cross-section of the y-axis. So you'll see an island. You'll see several islands. You'll see there's one island which is a high-mass interpretation of gamma, kind of in the middle of the plot. Nobody ever took that seriously. It was ruled out very early on. The inelastic scattering region is allowed, though. Well, it's now constrained by Xeno 100. But this is not, this whole paper assumes there's no inelasticity. Okay. Then you see these little islands down at low mass for gamma and Cogent. They're kind of close to one another, and there was a debate about whether they were, you know, actually right on top of one another. So Xeno 100 claims to have really pushed beyond that now. So what does that depend on? This is why I just want to draw your attention to where some of the bodies are buried, just so you know, kind of have a look at these things critically. So at low dark matter mass, the recoil energies drop, right? So xenon has to be able to detect nuclear recoils to low nuclear recoil energy. Now, this is a bit of an involved story, but I want to just draw your attention. It's the first figure in their paper, okay? So this should tell you it's kind of important. It's figure 1. It's this L effective thing as a function of energy, okay? KEVNR. So this is supposed to be their nuclear recoil energy unit. Okay? Now, what they tell you in the I'm not going to go. This is also a fairly lengthy story. It's fairly involved. But whether or not these experiments have any exclusion whatsoever or any sensitivity to these phenomena depends on how well they can detect scintillation from nuclear recoils at low energy. Okay. You don't know this a priori. They have to calibrate it. And at least for quite a while, there was no calibration data that actually demonstrated that the xenon experiments could even see low nuclear recoil energies in the range where Cogent and gamma would have it. Okay, so in particular, what they say here is that the nuclear recoil energy is inferred from the S1 signal. So they talk about S1 up here. This is scintillation light. Okay, and there's a formula given. Nuclear recoil is S1 over the light yield times 1 over L effective. That's an efficiency for collecting that scintillation energy. And that efficiency was really poorly measured. And so what they show is that they show measurements of this efficiency as a function of energy. And you see the data tapers out around 3 keV. Okay. Now, a couple years ago, if you actually look at the legend, you'll see that a lot of the black measurements, that's 2011 data. This is very, very recent. Okay. And actually, some of the other points, the little triangle points, those are 2010 points. So back in 2009, this data was really crappy, okay? The data was all over the place, right? You see this spread in data at higher energies. It wouldn't even go down to low energies. Nobody knew what the frigging efficiency was of that energy range. So there was a big debate about whether or not these experiments had any sensitivity. So this is progress. This is awesome progress. People have actually now measured this efficiency. I mean, this may seem like a technical point, but they measure this efficiency. The measurements go down to the energy range where these signals are, very close to the energy range. They're just a little bit above because the cogent recoil energies they were reporting were a couple keV. So they're actually kind of straddling these measurements. All right. But it's now good enough where I would say that xenon can make a pretty reasonable case that they have sensitivity to this. So that's good. That's progress. I was worried for a while that this would never get resolved. But again, there's not a nail in the coffin yet. I think there's still a few ways out of this. But with more data and especially more calibration, I think some of these anomalies are getting. Some of the interpretations of these anomalies are now being cross-checked. It doesn't mean that cogent and gamma don't have signals. I mean, we should remember that. It just means that the interpretations we had for the last few years don't work anymore. Okay. Are there any other questions actually about that? Was my lightning summary of like a 3-year saga involving gamma and cogent and now the xenon experiments? Well, this was the other reason that xenon 10. So you might be thinking of cogent. So xenon 10, xenon 10, xenon 100, they don't have signals, right? So actually, the other reason why xenon 10 was not able to rule out inelastic dark matter early on is that they took all their data in the winter, or at least the bulk of their data was taken in the winter, which is where the rate is the lowest. So xenon 100, I think, you know, they made sure that they got an awesome data set in the summer, you know, right in June and July, okay, so they could actually, there was no doubt about whether they'd have enough, they'd be at the peak of the annual modulation. But you asked about modulation. So are you asking, did cogent, because cogent had a signal, are you asking, did cogent see that?
No, we saw the modulation, right?
They didn't see a modulation. So cogent was reporting an overall rate discrepancy. So have you looked at the cogent papers? Okay, so cogent has a very low energy excess that actually looks more like an exponential. And it's an overall rate excess. So they're not looking at modulation, they're looking at overall rate. Okay, because they actively reject backgrounds, so they can beat the background rate to a low enough point where they can just look for the scattering and just count. And so they've got this they've got a low energy discrepancy, and they have not integrated enough data over a long enough period of time, I think, to be at a point where they're definitively sensitive to a modulation. But that was the first question asked of the cogent anomaly is, you know, does it modulate? Now, annual modulation is not the only modulation you can talk about. There's another big modulation you'd expect if you have dark matter scattering, which is daily modulation, right? Because the Earth's also rotating, so we go in and out of the WIMP with a much smaller velocity dispersion, but, you know, it's every day, right? So you can actually just check to see if there's a correlation. The problem is that to do that, you really want to have directional information in your detector. Well, that's a high rate. That's a huge rate. That's like, you know. But they have to wait a long time. Yeah. They need to collect much more data before they can answer questions about daily modulation or annual modulation, but that's what people are looking at right now. I mean, and you know, CDMS has also cross-checked their measurement, looking at basically the same energy range with basically the same target. They don't quite see the same excess, so it's a little unclear. But look, at least at this point, if you think it's light dark matter scattering elastically, that's not consistent anymore with the xenon 100 results. So we'll see what happens with cogent and gamma. I think a lot of people just want to know what the heck they're seeing. I mean, even if it's not dark matter, it would just be nice to know what they're seeing so we can, you know, be done with this. Well, now that Xenon 100 has only found three events with an expectation of 1.8, probably the next experiment to watch is, there's several, but I'm curious to see if KIMS has any results. So KIMS, in principle, they have the same kind of target material as DAMA. So one would hope that maybe we could draw some new conclusions about what might be causing DAMA or not causing DAMA based on KIMS results. But at least if you're trying to interpret any of this as an elastic dark matter, I don't think that will shed any light on the situation. One question you could ask is, what kind of future does this field have? Okay, I mean, have we like pushed the limit of, I mean, this is Xenon 100, so this is a little more than 100 kilograms actually of active material. That's a lot of xenon. So there are plans to upgrade all of these to the ton level, okay, and that's sort of hitting the limit of what's probably possible on a reasonable time scale. And there's a good reason to go that far, which is that if dark matter interacts with us, so there's only a finite number of ways it can interact with us, right? We know quite a bit about the symmetries of the standard model, so it's not like you can just write down random operators that couple dark matter to us. It can interact with us through the Z. It can interact with us through a Higgs. If there's any additional force carriers, like pseudoscalars or new vectors that can mix with us that we haven't detected, it could conceivably do that. Okay, so these are the so-called portals that maybe you've heard in various talks in the past. Very small number of options, okay, and all of these options give a parametric range of cross sections that you'd expect to see the scattering at. Z scattering, very large cross section. It's basically been tested. Sizable couplings of the Z and interacting through a Z, that most of that parameter space has been tested. The Higgs parameter space is the parameter space that's getting tested now. But you need to go a little bit further. So you see actually, for example, in figure 5 in that paper, you see that blob down there, sort of preferred range from some CMSSM benchmark models. Most of that dark matter is living off of Higgs exchange, okay? The Higgs exchange cross sections range anywhere from 10 to the minus 46 to 10 to the minus 44 centimeters squared. So that's why this whole experimental program to make a strong statement about whether dark matter couples to us through standard model weak interactions needs to go about one, maybe two orders of magnitude further. Then I think we have a definitive answer to the question, does dark matter interact with us through weak interactions? If it doesn't interact with us through weak interactions, it could interact with us through something else. There's a number of ways of looking for that. But if those results turn up null, then I think we're in a situation where we're gonna have a tough time. So first of all, there's neutrino backgrounds that start kicking in all these experiments when you get down to cross sections around 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared. So there's an irreducible physics background because there's neutrinos that are going to start scattering off your detector volume, and you can't get rid of that. It just looks exactly like. Maybe somebody will come up with a clever trick, but it'll get hard. So I think the way that we learn about dark matter is for the next generation of experiments now. I won't say it's the last generation, but it might be the next to the last generation that they actually start to see scattering. If not, I think, you know, we got a pretty reasonable answer to the question, which is no, it doesn't interact with the weak interactions with us. And it's hard to learn about gravity. Sorry, it's hard to learn about dark matter just through gravity alone. So we'll see. I mean, it's not bleak yet, but it would have made it much easier to learn about dark matter had Xenon 100 actually found a signal, okay? Because that would have meant that with the next generation of experiments and the generation after that, we'd actually be able to collect pretty decent statistics and, you know, study these curves. We could do directional detection with reasonable rates. So directional detection is another frontier that's totally fascinating. The targets are gases, and so when the dark matter comes in and scatters, the nucleus can actually recoil a sizable distance. You can actually track that distance in the direction. So now when you actually see candidate events, you can actually see it's like, it scattered that way, right? Because right now they don't know what direction the scattering occurs in. And as soon as you can actually get a direction, then you can use the day-night variation to your advantage. Because then, you always sort of know at any given point in time, you know, where is the halo coming from, right? You've got that piece of information. You can just check to see, hey, did the recoil happen in that direction or not, right? So it's an additional discriminator. So I think the future is interesting, but there's a very definite horizon that's approaching. So watch out for additional releases from Xenon 100, KIMS. There's experiments that are dedicated to probe this low recoil energy region. I think this is something that has to be pushed on, because notice we're hitting the boundary at high dark matter mass. But what are these? Look at the exclusions at low dark matter mass. They're very, very weak. Okay, it's much harder to explore couplings to dark matter if the dark matter is not weak scale. Let's say it's QCD scale. That's a frontier that hasn't really been pushed on. It's being pushed on, but that has a lot of room to go. So there's an experiment called COOP, which is more or less it's not an upgrade, but it's sort of a next generation. To go beyond Cogent, to probe low recoil energies. That's one that's not going to have results anytime soon. But in the future, that should have powerful results in this low recoil region. So that's something to watch out for. So I would say maybe one or two more generations of the big detectors to cover high dark matter mass, and then we get an answer to the question, does dark matter interact with the weak interactions? If it's heavy, if it's light, we have a bit more to do. Now, I think actually in the near term, you say what to watch out for. Watch out for the LHC. That's the experiment that can acquire rather direct, indirect evidence for dark matter coupling to the standard model through weak interactions. That's probably going to have data that's relevant much, much faster than the other experiments now. But then you, of course, always ask, okay, you made dark matter candidate, but is it really long-lived? So it'll just be indirect evidence. Any other questions about the dark matter results? Like eating up. So I might do a lightning. Anything about Dama, Cogent, Xenon 100, the future? No, and I'm totally serious about the LHC. This year is a pretty powerful definitive year. If dark matter couples to us to weak interactions, and there's something happening at the weak scale to resolve the hierarchy problem, if that connection that we've sort of thought is there for years, for decades, if that's actually true, we really should see something this year. And if we don't, the first assumption that we probably have to give up is that there is this tight connection between dark matter and the hierarchy problem. Okay, I'm going to sketch just how you actually calculate any of these correspondences in the table. Okay, because this just to sort of wrap up thinking about dark matter phenomenology, I think this will be in the homework. I don't have enough time to. Well, let's see. We could do one of two things. I can either sketch this calculation, or you could do it in tutorial, or we could and I could do that. I could either sketch it here, or you could do it in tutorial. If you do it in a tutorial, I'm happy to answer questions or talk about data challenges for the next 10 minutes or something. So what's the preference? Did anybody have questions or nagging thoughts about the data challenges that they wanted to talk about? Sketch? Okay. All right. So I think we'll probably focus on table 2 in the homework. So this is for fermionic dark matter. So if you're taking the non-relativistic limit of fermions, there's an appropriate basis to work in that makes life a little easier. Okay. All right. So you want to work in a basis. So I'm talking about gamma matrices now. Okay. You want to work in a basis where, remember these are 4x4. Work in a basis where gamma naught is 1 - 1. Just please work in that basis. All right. And then gamma I. The gamma i's in this basis are sigma I minus sigma I. Okay. These are 2x2. I'm writing this. Sorry. I mean, this may look like 2x2 notation. These are 2x2 blocks. Okay. And in this basis, gamma 5, 1, 1. Okay. Now, what you should do is just work through the Dirac equation. Just solve it. Okay. Solve it to leading order in velocity. Okay. So what do I mean by that? I mean, write p, write this as m times v slash minus 1, psi equals 0. Okay. So in this, so v naught is going to be 1 minus v squared over 2 plus higher order. Okay. So that we're just doing an expansion in powers of v. I mean, if you've ever derived the Schrodinger equation with relativistic corrections from the Dirac equation, it's the same procedure. You expand in powers of v and solve the Dirac equation. Okay. Well, in that case, it's just a rewriting of the Dirac equation. Okay, so let's go through this. So I'm going to drop the powers of m for a second and just keep powers of v here. So v slash minus 1, and I'm going to write this in terms of two-component spinners. Okay. Remember, in the non-relativistic limit, normally we talk about two-component wave functions, right? So it's usually the way that the way you see that is when you solve the Dirac equation in the non-relativistic limit, you have quote unquote a big component, and then you have a little component. The little component is related to the big component, but it's down by power of velocity. Okay, and what you sort of the thing that you actually see in the Schrodinger equation in non-relativistic quantum mechanics for a fermion is the big component, and the little component you've solved for, and you're solving for in successive powers of v. Okay, so let's just go through. So this is v naught, gamma naught minus 1 plus v dot. Okay, so I like to separate it like this. Why did I write it like this? Because v naught gamma naught has a term in it that's basically 1. So you subtract off a 1. Okay, so let's write this in matrix form. So this looks like minus v squared over 2. V dot sigma minus V dot sigma, and then minus 2 plus order V squared, which we can drop. Okay, so that's the matrix. That's the 4x4 matrix equation. These are 2x2 blocks. Okay, so here's my what this. This implies that chi here is minus a half v dot sigma times psi plus order v squared corrections. Okay. How do I want to write? Yeah. Okay. So basically, chi is related to psi through v dot sigma up to order v squared corrections. That solves this equation to order v squared. So that means we can go back and we can write our fermion fields as psi and then minus a half v dot sigma psi. The non-relativistic, I'm going to go ahead and just switch to the non-relativistic normalization convention, which is where you pull out a factor of root 2m. These now become mass dimension 1. They have an interpretation of what you're used to seeing in the Schrodinger equation. Okay. And then this is correct to terms of order v squared. All right. So this is the starting point for all of these calculations. Okay, start with this. Just solve the Dirac equation to order v squared. Well, you don't solve it. You just massage it into a form where you have one two-component field left, the big component, and then you can work out the correspondence. That's the most important clue. But let me just. Everything else is just now really simple algebra. Okay, this is the important thing. So, for example, if you want to work out, you can now work out psi bar psi, and this is just gamma matrices. Okay, and this ends up turning into little psi dagger psi times 2m plus order v squared. Okay, so this gives you something that does not depend on spin. So this would give you an operator that has a spin-independent piece. So the whole point of this table is that you'll see that there are terms that involve chi's, those are the dark matter fermion fields, and then they involve q's. Those are like quarks, okay? Those are the standard model fields. So for example, in the first term in the table that's spin independent, you see it's chi bar chi, q bar q. Right, psi bar, sorry, I should probably use the notation in that, whatever, q bar q. Right, this would just go to psi dagger psi, little q dagger q, times 4 mass of the, I mean, actually, this mass will end up turning into a mass of the nucleus, but don't worry about that, times mass of the dark matter. Right, so spin independent is just a product of the wave functions. It's sort of like the most vanilla interaction you can have. Okay, but then more interesting interactions or interactions that involved, not more interesting, just different, are psi bar. Now let me keep track of the velocities of the incoming outgoing guys. Because actually, psi bar psi, this comes with a V prime, this comes with a V, right? The incoming state has a velocity V, the outgoing state has a velocity V prime. You want to keep track of the recoil energy. You need to do that because that's a vector that can end up in the matrix element. Okay, so here's V prime. And you can have an operator that involves psi bar gamma 5 psi. Okay, this is just an exercise in algebra. Just expand out the matrices. Remember, this is I'll just do it once for this case. This is psi dagger and then minus a half psi dagger v vector prime dot sigma prime. These are two, I'm using two component spinners now when I switch over here, okay? 1 minus 1. Because remember that psi bar has a gamma 0 in it. Remember that's psi dagger gamma 0? That's what psi bar is. Does that ring a bell? Okay. And then gamma 5 is 1, 1. And then psi is little psi times minus a half. Now v dot sigma psi. And then all of this is times 2m. The m, just you can ignore the m's. Okay? If you do the algebra, though, I'm not going to go through all the steps, but if you do the algebra, this turns into v prime minus v, these are three vectors, dot psi dagger sigma psi. Okay. What is that? Well, this quantity here, psi dagger sigma psi, that's the spin vector. That's the spin. This is s dot q. For the dark matter, right? So this is a spin-dependent matrix element. So you know, you're used to seeing this all the time from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Now, this gamma 5, this can show up either with the nucleus or with the dark matter. What often happens, the term that matters, the term that you see all the time is you see a gamma 5 term with the nucleus, and that gives you a spin for the nucleus coupling to the recoil. Right? So that's why a lot of these spin, the so-called spin-dependent scatterings, you get a spin from the nucleus dotted into a recoil vector. And so to maximize the matrix element, you want to find high spin nuclei. OK, we can go through all of these, but they're all the same. All these calculations are, just remember to start from here. And then it's matrix algebra after that. OK. So the main reason for assigning this is just to build some intuition in your head for what the relativistic theories that you're used to playing with look like in the non-relativistic limit, because this is all non-relativistic. Sorry, not this, but the dark matter scattering phenomenology. Okay. I'm going to stop there. Are there any questions? Yeah, and feel free to continue with the data challenges. I mean, if you want to ask us questions, we can provide clues, after class or I'm here today and tomorrow. Yeah, unless you have questions now, that would be or clues that I can give now that would be helpful. I don't know if you want to focus on the homework or dark matter and tutorial, or if you want to. Yeah. One extra day would be good for the data challenge. But yeah, we don't have that. So, yeah, I guess we'll stop there. Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure the size is the right fit. I have some t-shirts.
Thanks.
Yeah. If they're not the right, let us know. We've got a lot of sizes.
All right, cool.